It's just a
We don't really run on our It's just not as fun. So
this is Solidarity Journal. Share in a common voice. Just might find your own.
To think that this was
John Doe.
It's like the argument about the arguments in part. No, we fought an entire goddamn war. States' right to do what?
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised.
It's Tuesday, August 9th, and you're listening to the Solidarity Journal on WAZU 90.7 FM, Peoria's progressive radio station and Pacifica affiliate. I'm your host, Michael Perillo, and today we'll have live local music from the Red Barn, from the band World History, and the Dirty Gentleman. Also, I spoke with Peoria bikers on the biking movement and culture here in Peoria, and what their main concerns are with drivers, and how we can help change our perception of bikers. Also, today is the 66th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I'll have my report on that next. So stay tuned to the Solidarity Journal, and prepare to be radicalized.
That's not the problem. Protecting the rich, denying the poor. They led to us a war from the White House and out there. How they sleep at night, how they sleep at night. I look back in so bad.
World will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. We won the race of discovery against the Germans. We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
And with those words marks the 60th anniversary of when the U.S. committed one of the single greatest acts of mass murder on a civilian population. Truman lied when it came to bombing Hiroshima and Nagasaki on August 6th, and then on August 9th, he called them military bases when in fact they were mostly civilian population. Granted, there were military personnel in the cities, but neither one was considered military vital to war planners. So the bombing deliberately killed the civilians in both cities. Theodore Van Kirk, one of the members of the Enola Gay, the man and the plane that delivered and dropped Little Boy onto Hiroshima, would decades later still not feel bad for what he did, and even angered that the Smithsonian planned an exhibit in 1995 showing some of the damage the bombing caused. He even gave a great interview on RT last year about how much the U.S. needed to kill innocent Japanese people.
Robert Oppenheimer, who is, of course, the mastermind behind the Manhattan Project, I read a quote from him, and he said, "You know, few people cried, most were silent. How did you feel when that bomb detonated?"
I was happy it worked. That's number one. You know, we had been in a long war. We had been attacked by the Japanese. The Japanese people were not nice people in those days. The Japanese you know today are not the Japanese we fought during World War II. The Japanese of today are nice people, but the Japanese during World War II were not that nice of people.
Do you think that the Japanese people will ever be able to forgive the Americans after all this destruction in both Hiroshima and Nagasaki?
Well, I don't know that will or not. If I had been living in Hiroshima or Nagasaki at that particular time, I probably wouldn't forgive them either, because those people suffered an awful lot. But whether they will accept it or not, dropping the atomic bomb saved their lives and our lives, Japanese lives.
In hindsight, do you think that there was any way to avoid using the atomic weapon, any other options that would have achieved the same goal?
Three main options. One was to put a blockade around Japan and starve the people to death. How do you starve people to death that are already living on 1,000 calories? You can't do it.
Do you regret being on that mission that dropped the first ever atomic bomb?
Do I regret the atomic mission? I regret we had to do it. There's a fellow here the other day, and what was it he was saying, that the Japanese should apologize to us for making us drop the atomic bomb? That was a new twist on things I've never heard before. But I regret that we had to do it, but I think we had to do it in order to end the war with a minimum loss of life. I dread the day when the terrorists are going to get nuclear weapons, because they are not near as thoughtful of the consequences of nuclear bombings as we are, as major powers are. And they will toss them around like matchsticks, I'm afraid.
And a lot of Americans still follow in Theodore Van Kirk's mindset that we should never apologize or recognize that day as an act of mass terrorism and an act that measures up to genocide proportions. When people justify this killing with the response of the Japanese would have never surrendered and this would have led to millions of deaths, they are wrong. U.S. intelligence had broken Japanese codes and new Japanese leaders were frantically trying to figure out how to arrange some form of settlement with Moscow as a mediator. At the same time, Secretary of War Stimson gave advice to Truman that the war could be ended in other ways besides dropping atomic bombs. Even top U.S. military leaders thought the bombings were unnecessary and unjustified, viewing the destruction of Japanese city as immoral, especially being civilian populations. General Dwight Eisenhower reports he reacted when he was told by Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson that the atomic bomb would be used, stating, "During his resuscitation of the relevant facts, I had been conscious of a feeling of depression, and so I voiced to him my grave misgivings. First, on the basis of my belief that Japan was already defeated and that dropping the bomb was completely unnecessary, and secondly, because I thought that our country should avoid shocking world opinion by the use of a weapon whose employment was, I thought, no longer mandatory as a measure to save American lives." Even that supposed number that was thrown out there, the one about millions of Americans, which later shrank a few hundred thousand, was made up out of thin air. And it's even sicker when you have John McCain trying to justify the bombings with saying that we also saved the Japanese more civilian losses for not invading them by saying, "I believe he, Truman, made the right decision, and I know it was a very tough one. American life is too precious." In some ways, as horrible as Nagasaki and Hiroshima were, it may have saved, in the long run, casualties of the Japanese people as well. So remember, folks, American lives are always above anyone else's, for we are superior, and that the Japanese should thank us for murdering them, since we would have done more murdering if we hadn't. Later on in life, Dwight Eisenhower would later state that it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. General Curtis Lee May was also appalled and disgusted with the use of the atomic bombs, stating, "The war would have been over in 2 weeks. The atomic bomb had nothing to do with the end of the war at all." Fleet Admiral Chester, Commander-in-Chief of the Pacific Fleet, went public with this statement. The Japanese had, in fact, already sued for peace. The atomic bomb played no decisive part, from a purely military standpoint, in the defeat of Japan. Furthermore, the Chief of Staff and the Five-Star Admiral, who presided over meetings of the combined U.S.-UK Chiefs of Staff during the war, William D. Lee, stated that the use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan. The Japanese were already defeated and ready to surrender. In being the first to use it, we adopted an ethical standard common to the barbarians of the Dark Ages. I was not taught to make war in that fashion, and wars cannot be won by destroying women and children. As for those who say the Japanese started it, That's not even entirely true. Since Pearl Harbor, a military base, evidence has shown a different story. There has been an 8-page 1940 memo by Lieutenant McCollum, which lays out the 8-point plan to provoke Japan into attacking first, which was implanted step by step by Roosevelt. John T. Flynn, a former columnist for the New Republic during that time, who would stand up to the war hysteria and call out FDR, makes the case that FDR had every reason to expect the Japanese to attack Pearl Harbor, and that he ignored the advice of his generals, and that he deliberately bottled up the fleet there, in Pearl Harbor. He reveals that the Japanese code had been cracked, and that the diplomatic messages being sent back and forth between Tokyo and its various embassies had been intercepted by the British, delivered to the Americans, and decoded. Later, Robert Stinnett, author of Day of Deceit, showed the decoded military messages sent by Japanese commanders before the attack. As Stinnett makes clear, Pearl Harbor was a very carefully calculated catastrophe, one orchestrated as much from Washington as from Tokyo. Roosevelt and his advisors, along with some cooperative officers in the U.S. military, worked to provoke the attack. For argument's sake, though, even if the Japanese were unprovoked in any way, that didn't justify what we did at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But back to the bomb itself. Robert McNair, who was involved and later admitted that the Gulf of Tonkin, which started the Vietnam War, was completely fabricated and a lie, here describes, in the documentary Fog of War, the horror he helped unleash alongside General Curtis Lee May, stating what the bombings were comparable to if it were to be used on cities in the United States.
The choice of incendiary bombs, where did that come from?
I think the issue is not so much incendiary bombs. I think the issue is, in order to win a war, should you kill 100,000 people in one night by firebombing or any other way? LeMay's answer would be clearly yes. McNamara, do you mean to say that instead of killing 100,000, burning to death 100,000 Japanese civilians in that one night, we should have burned to death a lesser number or none, and then had our soldiers cross the beaches in Tokyo and been slaughtered in the tens of thousands? Is that what you're proposing? Is that moral? Is that wise? Why was it necessary to drop the nuclear bomb if LeMay was burning up Japan? And he went on from Tokyo to firebomb other cities. 58% of Yokohama. Yokohama is roughly the size of Cleveland. 58% of Cleveland destroyed. Tokyo is roughly the size of New York. 51% of New York destroyed. 99% of the equivalent of Chattanooga, which was Toyama. 40% of the equivalent of Los Angeles, which was Nagoya. This was all done before the dropping of the nuclear bomb, which, by the way, was dropped by LeMay's command. Proportionality should be a guideline in war. Killing 50 to 90% of the people of 67 Japanese cities and then bombing them with two nuclear bombs is not proportional, in the minds of some people, to the objectives we were trying to achieve. I don't fault Truman for dropping the nuclear bomb. The U.S.-Japanese War was one of the most brutal wars in all of human history. Kamikaze pilots, suicide, unbelievable. What one can criticize is that the human race prior to that time, and today, has not really grappled with what are, I'll call it, the rules of war. Was there a rule then that said you shouldn't bomb, shouldn't kill, shouldn't burn to death 100,000 civilians in a night? LeMay said if we'd lost the war, we'd all have been prosecuted as war criminals. And I think he's right. He, and I'd say I, were behaving as war criminals.
Weeks before the first bomb was dropped, on July 13, 1945, Japan sent a telegram to the Soviet Union expressing its desire to surrender and end the war. The problem for the U.S. was that Japan objected only to surrendering unconditionally and giving up its emperor. But the United States insisted on those terms until after the bombs fell, and at which point it allowed Japan to keep its emperor. The United States Strategic Bombing Survey concluded after the dropping of the bombs that certainly prior to 31st of December 1945, and in all probability prior to the 1st of November in 1945, Japan would have surrendered even if the atomic bombs had not been dropped, even if Russia had not entered the war, and even if no invasion had been planned or contemplated. But still, to this day, bombings in other countries and the death of civilians continues. Wars continue, and we still do not care about the civilians. The only time we care about the civilians is when it gives us a pathetic excuse to remain in war longer, to protect those we have occupied and are killing. The atomic bomb pushed us forth into the Cold War, and it pushed us also into endless war. Upon dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, President Truman called the bomb the, quote, greatest achievement of organized science in history, and wondered aloud how atomic power can become a powerful and forceful influence toward the maintenance of world peace. Orwell would have been proud. Notice to the bikers on the road, and also at the same time letters to the Peoria Journal Star, where other Peorians berate and rant about how bikers get in the way. I wanted to find out more about the biking culture in Peoria, if there is one, and who's part of it, and what they're doing in the Peoria area to make people more aware of bicycling, and why is it they take the chances they do. I first went to visit Michael Honnold, president of the Illinois Valley Wheelam, a local cycling club. Michael has been riding since he was a junior at high school, which eventually brought him to organize group rides like the Peoria Bicycle Club here in Peoria that meets at L.R. Nelson, which is now Bosch, on Saturday mornings. That gives bikers a chance to ride 17 miles out of the day. He also spent 6 years organizing volunteers for the Proctor Cycling Classic.
Well, to me, it kind of gives me a way to connect with people I may otherwise not connect with. Because as president of the Illinois Valley Wheelmen, the non-racing club here in town, you know, we have members from, you know, 85 years old down to, you know, 14, 15-year-old kids who ride with their parents. And, you know, if I wasn't a bicyclist, I would, you know, have a difficult time connecting with those people. But since we have the common ground of bicycling, you know, talking about routes or bicycling gear, technology, whatnot, you know, I can connect with those people where otherwise I wouldn't be able to. As for the culture in Peoria, I say it's kind of fragmented. You kind of have your, you know, your Tim Beanies who are out there and trying to promote bicycling in Peoria. I think he's kind of created a counterculture with his kind of the non-racing closest thing we have to a bike culture in Peoria that he's trying to encourage.
I met with Tim Beanie across town. Tim Beanie is considered one of the more progressive riders in the Peoria area. He used to have a bike shop called Bicycle Bus. It was a bike shop that sold homebrew supplies and even had its own mountain bike racing team. It was really one of the only neighborhood bike shops on Main Street that repaired and maintenance bikes. Nowadays, he rides and promotes biking in Peoria. Are you on a type of campaign or a movement, or is it just something that you do for yourself that trying to get people more aware of the fundamentals of bicycling?
Well, I sometimes feel like it's a movement of one, but I don't know. I think a lot of times I try to present a different view on how to get around. And bicycling is the way I choose to do it and choose to promote to whomever I can and set an example by taking most of my trips by bike. I think a lot of times people are just so quick to grab the car keys, no matter if it's a 2-minute trip or a 200-mile trip. And many of those short-distance trips could be taken bicycle and save a lot of gas. And
I asked him what drivers should understand when it comes to respecting bicyclists.
Well, part of it is just if you're in a car, whenever I get into this discussion with anyone, I point out that it doesn't take that much time out of your commute or your drive to wherever you're going to safely pass a bicyclist, or wait until it is safe to pass, or even wait until going around a cyclist, until that cyclist turns off the road you're on. It doesn't take that long to wait. It's not going to, in the end of it all, it's not going to really affect your transportation. There's not, to my knowledge, we've never had a traffic jam in Peoria that was created by bicycles. So it's not going to, I guess for drivers, I'd just like to see them learn a bit more patience and understand that people are just trying to get around, and it's not going to hurt anybody. In fact, it could save a life if you just wait until it's safe to pass.
Mm-hmm. Michael also views it in the same way.
A lot of people in Peoria seem like they're in too much of a rush, and they don't really think that if they take 30 more seconds to go around this cyclist who is on the road, that they're gonna, miss where they're going, or delay their life any. And that's kind of the general feel I get. People are just in too much of a rush, and they don't take time to slow down and take our group into consideration. Because I've been to Europe once, and I got to do some riding over there, and over there it just seems, they're around bicyclists more. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like they were more easygoing. We had, at one point when I was riding in Europe, we had a guy trailing us for it seemed like 10 minutes because it was just a bad place to pass us. And he just didn't really mind, he didn't honk, he didn't yell, he didn't throw things at us like what's happened to me in Peoria before. He just kind of waited until it was a good time to pass and went around.
And then asked him what steps could be taken to change people's respect for riders.
Until they have a little bit more focus on it, as early as high school, where they start driver's ed training, and I don't think they cover as thoroughly as they should rules of the road for all road users. I haven't been in driver's ed for a long time, but I'm pretty sure it hasn't changed too much to where they're actually talking about the other people who use the road, and that you can use the road with something other than a car, and it's feasible transportation. I think until people quit thinking of the bike as more just a recreational vehicle or a toy or something like that, and start thinking of it as a real transportation option, when that starts to happen more, the other road users, the other motorists will have to be a little bit more open to having cyclists on the road. We have the same rules of the road. Mm-hmm. We're, by law, we're supposed to follow the same rules of the road as a motorist. And many times that doesn't happen. People, either by ignorance or laziness or just plain not paying attention, I don't think, unless it's been a late night and there's absolutely no cars around, I don't think I've ever run a stoplight. Now, stop signs in neighborhoods, I'll gently roll through. But it's kind of a cyclist. If they're going to be in traffic on city streets, it's kind of a cyclist's duty to follow the rules of the road and be predictable in their riding.
Mm-hmm. Michael agrees that bicyclists shouldn't act like they're invincible while on the road.
And also, I think a lot of the, I personally don't have a whole lot of trouble because I try and follow a lot of the rules of the road. I don't get on a bike and act like I'm immune to all laws and rules with bicycling, because legally, on a bike, you're supposed to behave like you're driving a car, and a lot of bicyclists don't, but I try to, and I think that when you exhibit a, that you're following the rules, cars give you more respect.
How do you view group rides?
Like the group rides I do on Saturday mornings with the Peoria Bike Club, some Saturdays in the summer when there's not a race going on, there could be 20 people there. Mm-hmm. And 20 people for a bike ride is a large group, because there's no way to really ride as a group. Because when you ride as a group, you try and, you know, ride so that, you know, you're blocking the wind so that you can maximize your efficiency when you ride. And when you do that, you usually end up taking up the majority of the lane that you're riding in. And I believe legally in Illinois, you're not even really supposed to ride 2x2. You're supposed to ride single file unless safety requires that you ride, you know, more side by side. And, you know, we really don't have a whole lot of problems when we ride in the big groups, but, you know, there's been times I can remember where, you know, as a group, you're riding through maybe a town where there's a four-way stop with a stop sign, and the group doesn't even stop because they just think, since they're so big, that, you know, they don't have to stop. Mm-hmm. And they just keep on rolling through. And I would agree that group think sometimes is a negative thing in terms of bicycling.
I asked Tim how is it that other cities and areas like Chicago are more bike friendly than Peoria.
I think a lot of people wouldn't expect Chicago to be biker friendly, but I think what's happened up there is that biking has become so popular that, and there's, you go up there, there's bicyclists everywhere, so everybody's adjusted to it. I mean, certainly there are car bike conflicts all the time, but again, the more people who are out on the roads commuting daily, the more at ease motors will be to have them there. There's definitely something to be said for strength in numbers. If there were large numbers of cyclists in Peoria, the cycling would be better, and the driving would probably be better too. I don't know. One thing I always tell people is that my health insurance has been bicycling. I haven't spent a lot on insurance, but I haven't been sick, luckily, and I have to give a lot of credit to my bike. And I don't even really, I rarely ever think of the exercise aspect of it when I'm riding. That's not why I do it. I just enjoy cycling for nothing more than, I mean, I enjoy it. I could weigh 300 or 400 pounds and still be on a bike, maybe, if I could find one that would fit me.
It's a lot more nerve-wracking driving for me.
Yeah. Well, with all the gadgets and devices that people like to try and use when they're driving, that can make it a little scary out there. But it's I don't know, all the way around, we'd all benefit if there were more people cycling. There'd be less pollution, healthier people, less road wear and tear, because bikes don't weigh a whole lot and don't.
I had a chance to speak with a Chicago biker and former Peoria resident, Cameron Beth Johnson, who told me more about those differences with biking in Chicago and Peoria. So how long have you been bicycling?
I started riding my bike when I lived in Peoria, but I started doing it more frequently since I lived in Chicago. And at first it was a super scary thing going to Chicago riding your bike, super nerve-wracking with the traffic and everything, but you slowly learn that it's a very friendly bike town and things happen, but you become very aware. And I really fell in love with biking in Chicago as opposed to here. Everybody notices a difference. Even though there's still conflict, there's always going to be conflict with it, with anyone driving a car versus a bicycle, but it's more received in Chicago as opposed to here.
Yeah, and what's the big difference in biking from Peoria to Chicago that you noticed right away?
The receptivity of drivers. Drivers, at least in Chicago, are very aware of where they are in their lanes and very aware that you own a lane. I can ride my bike all on the northwest side and stay in my lane. And yeah, I need to watch to get doored, or I need to watch where I'm going. But at the same time, like, they're not going to try to hit me, as opposed to down here, you're in their way. And there's a complete lack of consideration for who you are in this lane. As a matter of fact, you should get on the sidewalk, and they don't even know the fact that you're a moving vehicle.
She also said that bikers have a responsibility as well.
I definitely believe that if you're going to bike in a city and you're going to consider yourself a vehicle and you're going to be on the road, then you should abide by those vehicle laws. Like, you can't you know what the bike laws are, just adhere to them. That way you look good. You know, you're giving all of the bikers a good name.
There are other multiple problems in Peoria besides drivers. One is the conditions of bike lanes and how some don't even exist on the roads in Peoria. Michael talked about this at some length.
Well, from where I live here in Peoria, I use Reservoir a lot to get out of town, and Reservoir actually has bike lanes on it. But the bike lanes are not marked that well. They haven't been painted, it looks like, in years. Mm-hmm. And they're always littered with glass, an occasional branch. You know, they aren't picked up as frequently as they could be. So what I do, I usually, when I ride down Reservoir, I'll ride, my rule of thumb, or like when I'm riding down the road, I'll ride like maybe a foot to the left of the white line. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I consider my safe zone, because it gives me room to, you know, to dodge to the right if something gets in my way. Yet mm-hmm. I'm far enough out into traffic that people see me and have to consider that I'm there. Mm-hmm. I personally hate riding on sidewalks in town because I just feel more on edge when I'm on a sidewalk because people don't see you. Mm-hmm. So like when they're turning off the road, maybe onto another road that you're intersecting on the sidewalk, mm-hmm. or maybe pulling into their driveway, mm-hmm. they aren't really looking for you, and I'm just always looking over my shoulder because I know somebody's going to hit me.
Yeah.
Whereas if I'm riding on the road, I'm not on edge all the time.
Yeah.
For instance, Knoxville. You know, if you look at Knoxville, it's not, you know, there's no shoulder. It's basically a gutter that goes to the curbs. Mm-hmm. And for them to add a bike lane on there, you know, it would have to be done at the same time as a major road project. You know, I can't see them going in there just to add room for bike lanes, to add bike lanes. You know, it would have to be part of something else. And actually, there's a new law through the state that's called Complete Streets, where when they do projects like that, they must consider bike lanes. Like, for instance, the work they're doing on Northmore and Sheridan right now, if you've noticed, they're putting bike lanes in there because it's required by law. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as more projects like that are started and completed around Peoria, maybe, you know, eventually you will see bike lanes on University and Knoxville and, you know, the larger roads in town. But I think it's going to have to come as a result of something like that. I don't think it's going to be done just to do it.
Yeah.
For Tim, he's been campaigning and riding around trying to make people more aware in Peoria of bike racks being excluded from business areas.
The other thing I know that you're involved with is with the local businesses in the Peoria area getting bike racks. Can you kind of flesh out what that is all about?
What I'd like to see from the city, and this is something that other cities do have incorporated into their zoning or building code, that depending on the, just like when a business opens up, they have certain amounts of car parking that they have to be able to provide. Some cities do have requirements that provide for bicycle parking too, based on the presumed numbers of people who will be stopping at whatever the business is. And I'd love to see something like that going on here, and also a little bit of a design regulation or suggestion anyway on what kind of racks to use, because there's an old style rack that people or businesses typically like to put up that you can't really lock your whole bike to. And with quick release wheels, if you can't lock your bike, the whole bike, to the rack, then you're in danger of parts of it missing when you come out. Mm-hmm. And the style rack that could be used that would be more effective also takes up less room than what the old style racks do. So there's, you know, it's better all the way around if some thought is put into what kind of rack goes up, mm-hmm. because it very well could be, it could take up less space and hold more bicycles than some of the old racks that.
There are also the dangers of biking. Mike and I started talking about riders who have been injured and killed due to drivers around the Peoria area. In 2010 alone, 500,000 bikers are injured and 700 others are killed around the nation. In response to this, people around the country hold Ride of Silence, which has groups of bikers everywhere ride in their local areas in silence to remember those who have been killed while biking.
That Jesse Jackson, he was, I don't know if he's a member of the IBW or not, but he was training for a triathlon up by Princeville, and something happened, and he was hit by a car and killed. Mm-hmm. And then before that, there was, Diane Matuska. She was in the IBW, and she was riding down on, I think, Smithville Road, mm-hmm. and she was hit and killed by a rider. And it doesn't happen very often around here, but you know, we have had a few people who have been killed. And I would say the biggest thing we have right now in Peoria that promotes that is the Ride of Silence that we have every May, because I don't know if you've ever been to that, but you know, it's to honor, it's a national movement to honor cyclists who have been killed or injured while riding, and we started doing it about 5 years ago. And this year we actually had almost 200 riders come out. We do a 10-mile loop around Peoria, and you know, we have police escorts and the whole nine yards. And it's neat because it's starting to get big enough in Peoria where you have all those groups of cyclists come out. You have racers, and you know, everybody participates. And it's neat to see everybody coming together. Like the breast cancer walks, people are encouraged, and I do see a few people who do it. They'll wear a T-shirt or a sign on their back that says I'm riding for such and such memory or to honor somebody. And then we all wear armbands. We wear black armbands to honor the cyclist. And then if you wear a red armband, that signifies that you've actually been in some type of accident yourself with.
I met some of the riders at the Peoria Bicycle Club Saturday morning and spoke to a couple of them about their concerns with biking and people that they know that have been injured and killed due to other drivers. One of them was Mark Hetzel.
Do you know any personally people who've had...
Yes, I do. A friend of my brother's was killed, I think a couple years ago, out toward Dunlap area.
Motorist.
I think a pickup hit this particular cyclist. He was training for a triathlon.
Do you for the Ride of Silence? Do you do that?
Yes, we did. In fact, I did it this year. It started in Glen Oak Park, and we rode around Peoria for 10 miles to bring awareness to cyclists being on the road. Legally, we have the same rights as motorists, so people need to be aware of that. And in every case, the motorist is going to win the battle over the cyclist.
I also spoke to Eric Weber, a professor of philosophy at ICC, who told me his experiences with drivers.
People see me, that I'd be safe. Just 2 weeks ago, it was a Tuesday night ride. I was coming down Blue Ridge Hill. There at the bottom, there's a couple S's. And I was coming down the hill, and I moved to the center of the road. There's nobody behind me. I saw this guy in his white truck getting ready to come down the road, and he was... I always try and pick up their eyes, and he was looking the other way and pulled right out, and I had to hit it pretty hard to keep him going inside him. I did hit him a little bit, so I started yelling at him. He says, "I didn't see you." I said, "Well, you weren't looking." It's just people take a quick, I've had it happen out here, where they're turning, they just take a quick glance, and they're looking for a car, and that's all they're looking for. They're not looking for, my son's a runner, I mean, he runs on the road. They're not looking for, you know, people who are running, walking, doing other activities. Even motorcyclists are in danger, so... People in cars, they become very isolated because you're in a car most of the times with the windows rolled up, air conditioning on, radio on, and you don't have a sense of where you're at and your surroundings. And so the main thing is I want people to be aware to share the road. That is the law, to share the road. And it's not going to inconvenience them 30 seconds that much. Just have a little patience out there and realize that we're not roadkill.
I asked Eric what he would want drivers to know when it comes driving up to a biker.
Education's one, but on the road is if cars come up, we usually try and move over for them. Try and wave, try and not retaliate, but sometimes it's hard because people come up on you, just blast a horn for no reason whatsoever. Sometimes if people pass too closely, I'll hold up 3 fingers to say 3 feet. Some guys wear the shirts that say 3 feet because they're supposed to pass with 3 feet clearance. The main thing is just try and not retaliate, which is very difficult when someone is threatening. It's a threat. It's a physical threat to your person.
Do you know anyone personally or that has been killed or fatally wounded in bicycling?
I don't know anybody personally. I know I didn't know him personally, but the guy who was killed a few years back coming out of Princeville, the guy, he's on the road, on the shoulder, on the right, and the guy in the van says, "Oh, my tire blew out." He lied, and he basically was not paying attention and ran over the guy. That happened a few years ago up here by Princeville. People are too busy in their cars. You know, he was, you know, cell phones, texting, all that kind of nonsense. But no, I don't know anybody personally, although, you know, I've had my share of run-ins. I've had people throw stuff, bottles, firecrackers, you know, all kinds of stuff for no reason at all.
Yeah, Mike says he's been hit with a Coke bottle or a soda bottle that was full.
Yeah.
So you've had people, well, like you said, you've been hit by the one driver who wasn't paying attention, and then you've also had stuff thrown at you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, people think, you know, for whatever reason, they don't see you as a person. They see you as an object in their way.
Yeah. I mean, they must. to throw something at, you know, someone.
Right, and I realize that you have family and everything and so on. A good friend of mine, Dr. Tarantino, Mike Tarantino, a couple years back, we were riding up here by Dunlap, Park School Road. There was two guys on crotch rockets that were buzzing up down the road, and literally, I say on purpose, but others disagree, ran him over. Just tried to buzz him, but ran him over, put him in the hospital, and the guy just took off like a coward and wouldn't own up to what he did. I mean, they were riding on the side of the road, not doing anything, not bothering anybody. These guys on motorcycles thought they should have some fun, and he literally just runs him over. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's a, you know, a doctor, has a family, senseless. I don't understand people. And then to just stop, turn around, look, laugh, and then take off, you know.
Did they do that?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
And, like, you know, it was a game or something to him.
Cameron talked about ghost bikes in Chicago. That signifies a memorial for bicyclists who are killed or hit on the street.
So when somebody dies on whatever corner when they were riding their bike in the city, they've been hit by a car and they die in that corner. And it is a memorial piece, so it's the exact bike that they rode. And they paint it completely white and they adorn it with, like, you know, flowers, religious insignia, things that remind them of that person, and it'll say their name and the date that it happened on, and they're all over the city. There's, like, I read something where it was like 15 new a year happen. And
in the end, I asked them what keeps them returning back to the bike and the road, even for all of the dangers and possibilities of getting injured and killed, why they still ride.
I like riding because when I ride by myself, you know, I get away from other people. I don't have to talk to anybody while I'm out riding. I can kind of just download and process what's happened during the day. Or if I want to, I don't really have to think about anything at all. I can just think about the next turn or the next stop sign or you know, whatever. It's just a way to kind of decompress from the day. And as far as riding with other people, which I don't get to do a lot, I enjoy doing it. But it lets me, you know, interact with people I don't necessarily get to interact with during work, you know, where I spend probably the majority of my time right here at home. But, you know, you can kind of, you know, you learn from those people when you ride. You learn tips and tricks from them. And if you don't want to do that, like riding by myself, you know, I can not say anything when I ride with groups and just kind of do the same thing and decompress, but it's just fun to do it with other people.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Well, thanks.
Yeah.
That was good.
It's an individual act in most cases. I mean, you do find some group rides, but ultimately it's an individual thing. Even if you're within a group, you're still one person riding that bike. Mm-hmm. So there is that aspect solitude or being an individual, certainly. And that's probably part of what's drawn me to it.
I'm going to kill myself for saying this, but liberation and self, like, completely, like, you're self-propelling. You're going where you need to go within your amount of time. You have to watch for rain in case you don't want to get rained on. You're completely in all your elements. Mm-hmm. And it's a really beautiful thing to be physically in that control and to be a part of what's going on around you instead of in a little box. I mean, that's what motorcyclists say, right? Like, it's a totally different way to view the road. And isn't the road something we're all drawn to? Like, this is just the way that we look at it. And I just want some respect for that, as well as I give you your respect, you know?
For more information, check out www.peoriabicycleclub.com. Ivy Wheelam, that's IVWHEELMN.org. Also, you can find more information on Rite of Silence. And if you're on Facebook, Tim Beeney has a group called Your Average Joe Biker Club. Thanks for tuning in this week and listening to the Solidarity Journal at WAZU 90.7 FM. Tune in every Tuesday at 6 a.m. and 2 p.m. to hear local progressive exposés. Until next week, keep up the resistance.